Welcome to Soundbites. I'm Margot Stedman. I'm the Education and Community Engagement Director. I think the majority of people in the room know me. Good to see you all. And we are here for another exciting conversation. We are having a great week. We have Radu here with us. And of course, Mark Baldwin is going to lead the conversation. At the end, we'll be able to have questions like we always have. And I have no more to say. I'm going to hand over the microphone. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you. Yes, Mark Baldwin, voted least likely to want to sit in front of by the viola section for 43 years in a row now. I'm doing, and I plan on doing it as many more years as I can. I'm here talking with our current candidate for music director of the Rockford Symphony, Radu Papanyu. I hope I got that right.
That was perfect.
Good. Usually, as these good folks know, I like to start an interview with a fairly simple question, and that is, what's your story? Where do you come from? What started this journey here?
Very good. Well, first of all, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to wish you bon appetit. And my story, I will do a quick overview. So I was born in Romania. In a small town, it's called Robeta Turnu Severin. It's right on the Danube. It's actually right where the Danube comes out of the mountains, of the Carpathians. It all of a sudden gets wider. And my town, it's right there. It's about 100,000 people. And I started playing the violin when I was there at age 7. I actually really wanted to play guitar, and my grandmother bought me a guitar, and people were saying it's a little too big and I should start with a different string instrument. And that's how the violin journey began. And I enjoyed the violin quite a lot. I participated in competitions, but it was still that age. I still really like to play soccer and tennis. And it's very interesting when I look back, when was that moment when I really started loving music? And we'll get there in a second. But I was doing competitions, and my parents, at some point, we decided musical instruction in the town, it wasn't quite what it needed to be, and that was right when I was finishing sixth grade. So then we did a big move. I moved to Bucharest to attend a music high school there. Bucharest is the capital of Romania, and actually the same grandmother with the guitar, she moved there with me to take care of me for the following 5 years, and she did all the cooking and all those great things. I still remember coming back from a violin lesson, getting on the subway, and I would be dreaming of, you know, that pizza that's in the oven and it's going to be ready right when I right when I get home. Now, while in Bucharest, I started participating in this wonderful, it was called the Central European Initiative Youth Orchestra. And the orchestra still exists, but it has a different name today. But the idea was that it was sponsored by the Central European Initiative, and it had students from all the countries in Europe that are members of the Central European Initiative. So they did auditions in all these different countries, and we got to go there and rehearse orchestral music in the summer. We would go to Slovenia usually, which, if you've never been, it's a gorgeous country, and I had no idea before, but we would rehearse somewhere in the mountains for 2 weeks, 2 weeks and a half, and then we would tour Europe for another couple of weeks and play concerts in many different places. And it was, that's really when I fell in love with orchestral music, because I was experiencing, let's say, Beethoven 5, Scheherazade, pieces of that nature for the very first time. And you got to realize there was an incredible sense of community and companionship, because having students your age from all these different countries and all of us getting together and trying to communicate and form friendships, to this day, some of my best friends are from that time. Now, after that, this happened, I was in 11th grade, and my mother was doing all this research on the internet. She ran across a summer music program in the United States called the Perlman Music Program, and that is Itzhak Perlman's, the violinist, his summer music program, which is 7 weeks, and it happens on Shelter Island, New York. That's right off Long Island. And I sent an application. There's a really bit of a funny story there, too, because I never thought I was going to get in. When my mom told me, oh, we should apply, I was like, are you serious? I'm not going to get accepted into that. But I had played a recital at the museum in Bucharest. It was a full violin and piano recital. And I had some prominent favorites in terms of pieces. There was a Carmen Fantasy in there that I ended the recital with. There was also a cat in the museum that at some point is just walking across stage where I'm performing. And my dad was more nervous than me to film this, and we didn't have a tripod. So a little bit of the video is just going like this. But to my surprise, I was actually doing an outreach concert with a quartet from my music high school in not a very good area of Bucharest, and I get a call, and I noticed it was a plus one number. It looked really unusual. And to explain to you how bad the situation was, I was a little bit scared to take the phone out and take the call because I thought someone might just take my phone away. But that's when I got the call that I was actually accepted into the promo music program. And I went for two summers while I was still in a high school. It was a completely life-changing experience. It's an amazing place where you are surrounded by music and by an incredible sense of community. And if you have the time, I will tell you that what a day looks like. You start in the morning, you stretch for 20 minutes with everybody. There's a stretching session to avoid injuries. After that, well, breakfast, you have 4 hours of individual practice with breaks in between. And the idea is you don't actually have to practice the whole time, but you need to be in that room that is assigned to you. And I did get in trouble a couple times, and I had to do punishments like cleaning the laundry room and things of that nature. After that, you do violin lessons, chamber music in the afternoon. Perlman is the violin teacher. He's present during those 7 weeks. He does not take any other gigs. He's present for every single activity. He participates in every single meal. So the afternoon, you can rehearse with your chamber group. You might have a lesson, or you might have a chamber music coaching. 5 o'clock, everybody sings in chorus, including all the faculty and including everyone else. There's dinner, there's orchestra, Perlman conducts, and then there's sight reading music parties after that. If I were to pinpoint to a moment in my life when music became about something else that was bigger, about just playing the violin, bigger even about the compositions, was this moment when it was really about community and about how it can change you as a person. It was that. And as a matter of fact, I loved it so much that I wanted to apply to conservatories in the United States. And I ended up going to the Colburn Conservatory in Los Angeles for 7 years. I got 2 degrees in violin performance. And after that, I went to the New England Conservatory in Boston, where I got my master's in orchestral conducting. Now, I really started conducting. It was my sophomore year in college at Colburn when I was studying violin. And the reason for this is my violin teacher thought when I was playing in my lessons and on stage that I was just moving a little bit too much. And violin is already, I have to tell you, it's already difficult enough. And when you move a little bit too much, everything becomes a moving target. And it makes it even more difficult. And he also saw me play ping pong, and he thought I was, he says, very natural at that, and that it might translate well to conducting. But that's really how it all started. And okay, on that side note, Colburn Conservatory there was the biggest sports event in a conservatory, a ping pong tournament, and the final happened in front of the entire school, and I played the final twice and lost it both times. In any case, I started doing an unofficial class, and they didn't have a conducting program, but it was almost better that way because I was the only person interested in it, and a lot of opportunities happened for me because of that. They have an outreach week every single semester where they take the orchestra on buses and they perform concerts at schools throughout the Los Angeles county, and at first, the first couple of years, I would get to do a couple pieces on these programs. And after that, they no longer had an assistant, or he was busy the first year while they were still having it. And they trusted me with planning those concerts, programming them, presenting them to the community. So I got a lot of hands-on experience before really studying, in a way, conducting officially. After that, I went to the Aspen Conducting Academy while I was still a violin student. That's in Aspen, Colorado. But I still wanted to study it as a degree for two uh, for 2 years. So I did the master's at Boston in NEC. Right after that, I went to Florida. I've been with the Naples Philharmonic for 5 years, 2 years as assistant conductor, 3 years as associate conductor. I am still with them as associate conductor. And I'm also music director of the Naples Philharmonic Youth Orchestra for the past 5 years to present day. And also, as of July 1st, I was appointed music director of the Southwest Florida Symphony, which is in Fort Myers. And those are the spark notes. Yeah.
So you've been conducting in Florida now for a number of years, and you really want to come to Illinois for part of your season.
I find the cold air very refreshing.
Perhaps you answered this, but I was wondering, when was it that you started to think seriously about making conducting? I mean, obviously you still play. I've been listening to people talking about your playing in Florida. You still are active as a violin player. But what was it that made you think, I want to do conducting and play an orchestra in addition to playing the violin?
Yeah, it's a very tricky question. And the honest answer was that it was very, very difficult to me, because I really dedicated myself fully to the violin, to the point that it was almost an obsession. I just, to this day, I love it. I think it's just, it's an art. There's the art of music and there's the art of playing the violin. And it's just incredible. And it was very, very hard to let go. And what I found, though, when I started doing conducting, and I was very, very lucky, because the first few experiences of conducting were extraordinarily positive, and people were very, very supportive. And it was at the time when I was doing some very pretty extreme technical changes on the violin, which was very hard psychologically, but they started complimenting each other in a very natural way, and it was a way that was also very healthy for me, because I learned certain things. Because with conducting, the first few experiences when I conducted were positive, so I developed a habit of feeling very excited and good about that moment when I walk in front of the musicians or on stage. It was a very positive experience, and violin came with a lot of baggage, and I felt like I was all of a sudden experiencing music in a new way. It was still music, and it was amazing. Wow, I can do music in a different way. And it really helped my violin playing, actually, in many ways, in terms of subjects like performance anxiety. I felt like I was able to learn so much from conducting, going back to the violin. But it was also the fascination. All of a sudden, you're looking at these scores, which, in my opinion, they're some of the greatest creations that we have as human beings. These orchestral compositions are just truly incredible, and that's all. The more time you spend with them, you realize how much more there is to learn, and just how incredible they truly are. And I think the only thing that really competes with them is perhaps the string quartet repertoire. You see, I'm string biased. I'm really.
I don't blame you.
But that ability to spend my days just looking into, it's like being at the Louvre every day, just being able to explore this. And with the violin, the other thing that I found just a little bit limiting in a way, it depends, you know, people love to do different things. And once again, I love the violin. But for me, at some point, the idea, look, if I get asked somehow still today, would you play the Tchaikovsky violin concerto in a month and a half? Let's say the answer is yes. What that means is that for the next month and a half, every day I will be shredding for hours the Tchaikovsky violin concerto and practicing, because that truly there is no way around it. And if I was asked, would you conduct Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony tomorrow, the answer would be absolutely yes. There's just there's almost a physical limitation in terms of how much repertoire you can explore in a period of time as a soloist or as a very high level instrumentalist. And with conducting, I love this ability to just be basically diving into just huge amounts of repertoire. It basically changes every week, and I find that so incredibly stimulating. And I to this day, I just consider myself an everyday student of music, and it's that's where I get this excitement for. And then think about it. Okay, you have this incredible moment of going to the library. It's like going to the library, going to the museum, and you try to go as close to the source. And then many times the orchestra changes every week, and you get to make music with a lot of different people. And that's really fascinating, because every place has its tendencies, and people have their strengths and weaknesses. And it's just, it's an extraordinarily fascinating process. And after that, yet another element, you get to share it with the audience. So I that's why I can't think of anything better to do at the moment.
Now, when I tap my phone here, please don't think I'm trying to make mention to shorten you. I'm not. Being from my days as a radio announcer, you are my favorite kind of interview. I ask a question, and I can go get a cup of coffee, come back, and he's still answering it. And trust me, I have had interviews where I ask a question, and before I finish my question, they've finished their answer. And that is not fun. It makes for a very long half hour, trust me.
Well, it's a subject I like talking about.
I noticed that. And there's several things I'd really like to ask you, but I do want to make sure we have time for everything. As a conductor, how do you go about learning the score? You say if you had to do Tchaikovsky, you know, a violin concerto, you'd need a month. If you came to me and said, Mark, I want you to do Brandenburg 2, I'd say, okay, I need at least 6 weeks to get it going. How do you go about studying a score? How do you go about learning a new piece, adding a new piece to your repertoire to the point where you feel that you can just say, tomorrow, okay, let's go?
Yeah, so, those shredding days have happened on Tchaikovsky 6 at some time. And the idea is that the main difference, you know, and I'll go back to your question, is the fact that the technicality of it, it's the study of the score in conducting, that it's really that process that takes a lot of time. And I mean, what I do, I at first I really go through the score really slowly, just looking at every page and trying to grasp as much information what's actually written there. The one thing that I, to this day, and every single conductor has a different, completely different process in some ways. A huge advantage at first I felt for myself is that I had played in orchestra most of the standard repertoire. So it was already ingrained in a way in terms of having it be in my ear and having a bit of a feeling for it. I always do a phrasing analysis. But this is very interesting, because it's not per se what you would think in terms of how am I going to phrase that phrase. I'm really trying to look from the conductor's perspective. How is it constructed? It's a little bit like architecture. And I try to put everything in blocks. And with all honesty, if you look at one of my scores, I took this system because I found it that it was very helpful for me. I was looking at the New York Digital Archives, and we're so fortunate today. That's why for study is the best time in the world that's ever been. They have the entire Bernstein collection of scores online available for free. It's literally a click away. And I really like his system of doing this. I don't mark it exactly the same, but I go through the same sort of phrase analysis structure. Now, I was very fortunate while at Colburn, there was a theory teacher by the name of Bruce Miller. To this day, he is one of the brightest men I've ever met. And we had the theory classes, but what happened, and actually the school was sponsoring this, which was truly incredible. He decided, at some point, there was one more person interested in conducting. He started giving both of us these private sessions, and the school was actually paying for it. But it was supposed to be 1 hour, and I remember it to this day. We would meet at 7 p.m. on Thursday night, and it would usually end around 11 p.m. That's how passionate and generous he was with his time. And we have gone through a lot of the major repertoire from the score, chord by chord, doing a full-on harmonic analysis. And in some cases, it's one of those things I can, first of all, you know how time-consuming.
Oh, yeah, form and analysis was one of my, not my forte, if you will. But
imagine looking at every instrument, putting all the notes together, and trying to figure out what every single chord in the composition is. And for a big symphony, it takes somewhere over around 2-3 weeks. I mean, it's just really, really time-consuming. But the depth of knowledge that I gained from that time with him to this day, I am just extraordinarily grateful. But let's go back. So we have phrase analysis in terms of architecture. We're looking at blocks, kind of like that pillar like there. You see, that's a little bigger, that's a little smaller. The pieces of music are constructed the same exact way. There's harmonic analysis, extraordinarily time-consuming. I've personally done it on a vast majority of the standard repertoire in that way. After that, there's how are we actually going to phrase every phrase? And that's when it really gets, once you get these building blocks, the question becomes, what do you want to do with it? And that is really fascinating, because a phrase can go in a million different places. Then you got to look at the big picture. That's when you start looking at form analysis, and you have all those terms, sonata form, rondo form, and now we're talking really big blocks. So you start very, very small, and you go more out, more out, more out, and then there's musical style. How much do you know about that composer, about the performance practicing in that time? That what kind of style, what kind of sound? What kind of vibrato in the strings? What kind of length of notes? It's truly a never-ending process, but that's really what makes it fascinating. And in the end, once you've done all these things, the last question is, what do I actually want to say with it? And you got to have a clear enough message to try to convince the musicians, which is not always easy, because think about it. They have spent, in a way, the same amount of time on their instruments and playing this fantastic composition. So they're great musicians themselves that have very strong ideas about what they want to do. So then your case has to really be quite convincing. But yeah, that's, in a nutshell, kind of how I go about it.
I want to get, in a little bit, I want to get into a little bit more on how you feel the role of an orchestra is in the community and your role in that. But I have one more question that's kind of for me. Is I have always been fascinated by various interpretations and how interpretations of music have changed over the years. I have a fairly sizable record collection, and it just got increased by about 6,000 LPs. Yeah, I got given a collection of recordings, wonderful old recordings, but you look at, you know, like opera from Furtwängler through, you know, Mengelberg and all the old conductors. And what I'm trying to get is, where does your kind of interpretive heart lie in terms of conductors that you listen to and go, that's how I feel, or a conductor and you hear, well, yeah, that's not how I do it, but I get it. You know what I'm saying? Is where and what pieces, what literature is closest to your heart?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Well, it's going to be another long answer, and I'm really sorry.
We got time. We're cool.
First of all, I just want to give credit to someone, because when I think of, in a way, the musicians that has influenced my life the most, it's this violin professor in Romania. His name is Ștefan Gheorghiu, and if the violin school of Romania truly has a history, it's because of him. At some point, he had 30 concertmasters around Europe, some in the United States again. But what was so incredible about him was understanding of musical style. And he forced me from grade 8, 9, 10, 11, and senior year of high school. Every year I had to play a full violin recital with piano that included a wide range of musical styles. And to this day, to me, I think he had some of the deepest understanding of musical styles that I have ever seen. And it was also the way he was teaching it. You almost can't explain. It was the little markings that he would put in pencil on your music, and then you start playing. And he was really old at the time I was studying with him. He has this very kind of deep voice and kind of sing with you that way, and you'd be playing. But something happened to every single student in a way that he was passing that over to you in a most natural way. And you almost didn't realize when you started thinking a little bit like him, because you would do it enough that it just becomes a little part of you. So I would say that is my strongest influence when it comes to styles. And then in a way, when I hear something that in a way fits that criteria a little bit, that really, really speaks to me. Now, when we're looking at recordings, I like looking more at a period of time, let's say before kind of the 2000, before 1990. And I think the recording industry has changed a little bit, classical music, because if you listen to the really old recordings, what you will notice immediately is that they were so distinctive. You can almost guess who the ensemble and the conductor is. I mean, I'll tell you, with violinists, for sure you can pick up their sounds because it was so individual. And, you know, if you hear Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Normandy, or the Tchaikovsky Serenade for strings,
and you knew exactly who it was.
It's because of the sound. I mean, it's just, it just hits you. It's unmistakable. And the reason I think everything was so distinctive is because they didn't have recordings before. So every place really got a chance to develop its very, very individual style. Now, what's happened over the years, recordings became available, but not just for the listener, also for the artist. So people all of a sudden were inspired by these other artists, and little by little, there's another thing that happened. All of a sudden, at some point, we added editing into the recordings, which made the technical level of performances extraordinarily high. I mean, if you get a CD these days, you're not going to find mistakes on it. It's got to be a pretty clean performance. But in my opinion, there's something that's been lost with that, because we're looking for this perfection, and it's very, very hard to guess a modern violinist today, because the technical level is extremely high, but it's almost like we're all aiming for something that's a little bit similar. And in my opinion, that is a little bit of a loss, because I'm sure we can all agree life is not perfect. So why should music be?
Oh, boy, could you and I go back and forth on this a lot. I'd be real careful, because I could spend the next 2 hours just talking with you about this, and unfortunately they wouldn't want to hear it. But to your point, another thing about that is that as orchestras developed back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, each orchestra, because there wasn't a lot as much travel, because partly because of the recording thing, but also a lot of orchestras were very ethnic. And that very ethnicity helped to dictate their sound. The Chicago Symphony has always been a very Germanic orchestra. New York had a lot of Russians in the violin section, a lot of Italians in the woodwind section. And because they came from these various schools of playing, they played that way. And that helped give each orchestra its individuality. And people go back and forth as to whether orchestras have become more homogenous, the playing has become more homogenous. I personally think it has. I'm not saying it's good or bad. But going back, if you listen to Toscanini in the NBC Symphony, I can hear Harry Glantz playing first trumpet on his B-flat trumpet every time. And you go to Boston, and I can hear George Majere playing on his C trumpet. And you go to then New York, and you can hear William Vacchiano playing on his D trumpet. You know, they're very individual. And before we were talking about, and I'm going to stretch this just for another minute, I got the feeling that you're a fan of Raphael Kubelik as a conductor.
I love his line about the piece we're performing a lot. And I think it's there's something about the style for Dvorak that he has. And we're playing a particular Dvorak piece that I find it to hit very home to the music itself. Mm-hmm. So that's why I like it.
Especially in you know, Dvorak, music of that area of Europe. He's just remarkable. Let's switch gears. In leading an orchestra as a music director and leading an orchestra of our style, size, type, regional orchestra, how do you see it being involved in the community? What do you think is the mission, to use a, I think, cliched term by this point, the mission of a Rockford Symphony in a city like Rockford?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and we've been talking a lot about this week, and it's actually brought some more ideas to myself personally too. But I think there are three things that are very, very important to me. First of all, of course, we need to present music at the highest possible artistic standard, and that almost goes without saying. Now, after that, it's really this word that comes to mind. We need to make that music accessible, and accessible not just in the sense that we have those I don't know, 6 masterwork concerts and another 3 pops, and we have the people that come to those. But how can we truly make it accessible and relevant to everybody in the community? And that leads me to the third very important thing, which I think is education. I think the great thing is that when you have, all of a sudden, you have an orchestra in a community, and you've had an orchestra here in the community for a very, very long time. But a new community that gets a new orchestra, all of a sudden, there's opportunities for more violin lessons. There's opportunities for lessons for every instrument in the orchestra. And I'm envisioning a world where the musicians are truly involved, very actively involved in this aspect of education. Now, the role of the music director, I want to go back to this word accessible. I think aside from the musical duties, the music director needs to have a very strong voice in the community and to be an educator of music, and an educator also for an adult audience. I get the feeling that you're already very seasoned listeners, and many of you know why classical music is that great. Well, I think it's the responsibility of the music director and the musicians to translate that to everybody in the community. So I see the music director being absolutely active, presenting lectures, going into the community. A big idea that I have for the Rockford Symphony Orchestra is to reinstate an idea of presenting outreach concerts throughout the Rockford area, and the programming for this to be done in a very logical way. A concert that has a little bit for everybody, and it's really presented in that way that everybody feels welcome. I think we're at a point in history, especially after the pandemic, if orchestras are to survive, musicians and in particularly conductors really need to figure out how to explain to everybody how great it is what we actually do. And I really believe that every person deep inside, they love classical music. They might not know it yet, but it is impossible not to love. And to finish this, I basically see the orchestra, I can't come up with a better word right now, but it's a temple, a cathedral, where everybody in the community can in a way feel welcome and can gain something from it, whether it's something to do with lessons, whether it's parents are involved for a family concert or they leave the kids at some sort of an orchestra event, whether it's youth orchestra or there's some other lecture-like activity, and they feel like, wow, look, they're going to learn something and we can go do something else for an hour. Then everybody in the community should feel that it's a place where you go and you're nurtured somehow, and they can choose what it is that they want to be nurtured by. But I think the orchestra needs to offer this variety of things that truly enhances a community.
Getting a little, continuing on with the specifics, given no budgetary restrictions, what type of outreach things would you like to do specifically in terms of getting out into the community with not only youth education, but also just getting the orchestra more present in the area?
Right. So basically, because there's so much talk today about how can orchestras be more inclusive. And I personally, I can't think of a better way than just taking the music in the communities where this kind of music does not exist. We go into their home and invite them into ours. Because I think a lot of orchestras are expecting that people are just going to come to the concert hall, and it's a really tough step to take. And I was I'm repeating myself. I was saying this earlier in the week, but I had a very eye-opening moment in Romania when I was doing a concert, and one of my very best friends from growing up, I invited him to the concert, and he said, texted back, "Well, I can't come because I don't have the right clothes for tonight." And I immediately wrote back and I said, there's absolutely no dressing code. Just come. It doesn't matter. And he still didn't come because he just felt that somehow he's going to be embarrassed because he's not going to fit in this circle. In terms of outreach, I'm envisioning, I call it a date with the orchestra, this kind of program that I have in mind. And it's inspired by a program that I did in Naples that it's called Overtures. And some of you might have been present sometimes. Basically, what happened there is someone gave, this goes with your premise, because you said if there's no financial limitation, okay, but it can be done with financial limitation too. But how it happened there is someone all of a sudden came in and gave a lot of money. And he said, "I want one night every season where the orchestra plays the pieces I actually want to hear." And what for that person, what this meant was that there will be all the famous overtures that you would recognize. And, you know, they're performed in Bugs Bunny and all those Looney Tunes. And when I got there, I saw it as an opportunity, not just to play the pieces, but to really say something in between every piece about what we're about to do. And at first, people didn't know what to make on it. Now, don't worry. Between pieces, I'm not talking as much as right now. I'm actually very careful about that, because I think there's a sweet spot how much you can push it and what is just the right amount, because people are there for the music. But it became an extraordinarily popular concert there. And the reason why it was so fascinating from the standpoint of the administration and myself as well is that they were looking at data from the ticket sales, and it wasn't the regular subscribers. It just seemed like it was a really nice introduction to the orchestra, and we would put the occasional, a little bit like the program tomorrow, there would be an occasional Broadway overture or a Cowboy overture, John Williams, or some other John Williams piece, or something else that was from a different genre. And we just noticed it was a very, very different crowd. So I'm envisioning something like this can be done even with a, let's say, chamber orchestra size that perhaps doesn't need to be quite so expensive. And it can be, I can envision this being done with a little less rehearsal time as well, and fitting in a smaller space. And that's why it's something that could really be taken around town. It can be performed outdoors. It can be performed in a high school auditorium. It can be performed in a community center. Now, to relate to the community in a way, you know, it's another program that I've done, and I never thought of it as an outreach program, but while I was driving around Rockford, it is my understanding there's people like sports quite a bit here. I've designed a program that is really, the theme is baseball, and it goes throughout the whole program. And that's something else that perhaps, you know, someone is not thinking, "Oh, I'm going to go to the symphony," but then they see, wow, a program about baseball. And then, you know, we go right into their community, and all of a sudden they realize, wow, all this music that I love is performed by a symphony orchestra. Now, that's really cool.
What do you see as yourself getting involved in the community personally? Not as the conductor of the orchestra, but as the music director and being the face of the orchestra. How do you do that in your own current role, and how would you like to be doing that?
Yeah, what I've introduced, where I started immediately, a series of lectures that I'm taking around town. This came fairly easily because I've been doing them already for 5 years in Naples, and I had a number that I already pre-planned. I do things like, what does the conductor actually do? It's super fun. It's in a TED style kind of way. There's one, it's called Inside the Orchestra Rehearsal, when we look at both how do the musicians and conductor prepare for that. I do something called Architecture in Music, where I look at buildings from all over the world and compare them to the musical forms that we have in classical music. And to give you an example in that, the White House, it's an ABA form, which is an aria da capo. And that's really how sonata form really kind of began. But it becomes a lot more obvious when you see the whole presentation. I do a presentation of El Sistema, how that started and how it completely changed the community. I do a history of the symphony as a genre. And these are all presented in a very friendly and interactive way. We look at sonata form with Oreo cookies of different kinds, and we track Beethoven Fifth Symphony First Movement and Eine Kleine Nachtmusik with the laser and the Oreo cookies, and I guarantee everybody in the room understands it immediately. You already have a podcast. I just started a podcast over there. It's called Sharp Listening. The idea is I also treat it more as a recorded pre-concert lecture, and it includes musical examples. I'm actually recording the first episode over there next week because I was working on cutting the tracks this morning. Very, very interactive. The idea, even with the title, is that Sharp Listening, it gives the listener a chance to learn a little bit about the music and grab onto certain things. So then when you're listening at the concert, it's just going to be extra enhanced. And I see things like what we're doing today that are just absolutely essential. It's happened many times after concerts that I receive more comments about the things that I said than sometimes the music itself, which I don't think there's anything wrong to that, because I think language, in a way, for some people that are not quite so used to classical music, it's just something that we all relate to. I just find it my responsibility to tell everybody why I think music is amazing, because I do think that.
We always get a question when we open it up to the audience, if I haven't gotten there first. So I want to see if I can get there first. You've obviously done work with orchestras, with choruses, and bring that. Do you see any differences in working with a chorus? And is that something you really enjoy doing, is bringing a chorus into the orchestra and doing things that require that?
I absolutely love it. And I started with the first time I conducted a chorus was really in Naples during my first season. And I was thrown in, a few weeks in, Messiah, the whole thing. It's quite large. And I loved it. It was actually a completely eye-opening experience, because I've been playing music from the pre-classical, Baroque, and classical era for forever, as in my life, forever. And I never understood, well, certain articulations, certain slurs, why was it happening that way? And it turns out it all had to do with words and breathing. So all of a sudden, everything just made a lot more sense. And what I loved, well, here's something that's really fascinating. When you think about an orchestra, you have a few families of instruments. The strings are making sound like this. The winds and brass are blowing air through the instruments. And then you have the percussion. They're scraping, shaking, or hitting something to make noise. There are three completely different ways to go about producing a sound, and yet it all has to work together. And in some cases, it works really well, but it's not easy. Now, with a chorus, every section does the same thing, right? Oh, it just kind of goes like that. So it's something that people immediately connect, and having the same technique, any type of course, a community course, I feel that a conductor can immediately have an effect on, because people are all using the same instruments. I've also found that pretty much all the time, everybody who sings in a chorus, they're there because they really want to be there. And rehearsals are just extraordinarily fun. But of course, combining the orchestra with the chorus, I mean, it's just a wonderful thing. It's just powerful. You all of a sudden, you're using basically all the resources that we physically, acoustically have to produce sound, and you take it to a wonderful space. And yeah, it's a life-altering experience by the sheer power of the act.
I want to keep track of my time here just because, well, yeah, we've got plenty of time. Any questions? I'd like to open this up to anyone in the audience who might want to ask a question. Let me know. Ma'am.
I'm assuming that you still play the violin. Would that be correct? Do you play the violin like in a concert situation? How is it that you, when you're playing the violin, how do you decide you're going to follow the conductor?
Oh, what? Yeah, there's a question for you. When you're playing the violin and you've got someone else in front of you.
Yeah. Oh, in terms of that, well, so to answer you, I do play the violin. I wouldn't call myself, I would say professionally what I do, it's 100%. Conducting. I mean, I do get paid for the occasional violin gig, but I really don't think of it that way. It's really it's one of those projects of love. I still do it because, honestly, I just really miss it sometimes, and it was such a part of me. I still have this thing that if I have a day where I have time, I've noticed that if I do my scale in the morning the way I used to do it with my teacher, I just feel better for the rest of the day. It's almost like a guilt that once I've done that chore, it's, and of course I can't do it all the time. And I've learned to let go of that. In terms of playing, look, I really think music, if we learn something from music, is the idea that if we work together, the world would be better. And I think that's, in a way, that's in a nutshell the music of a symphony orchestra. And of course, every single person has their own personality, their own ego. And I 100% understand that. But especially after being on the other side, I would try to do what the conductor is asking for. But it gets tricky. Of course, there's some people you connect with. There's some people who you think, okay, what they're saying makes sense. But I'll give you this. I run a chamber music program as part of the youth orchestra in Naples as well. And I hold a meeting with everybody before they go into their groups to rehearse and have coachings. And I say, there are only two rules that you have to remember from day one until the rest of your life. If you're in a rehearsal and someone has an idea that you love and says, can we try this? What is the answer? Yes. If you're in rehearsal, someone has an idea, you think it's terrible, but they want to try it. What is the answer? Yes. And I think that answers the question. It's always try. Always try, and ultimately you will feel better yourself. That's the secret. It's a game of giving. You give and it comes back.
And that can be a whole conversation with orchestral musicians, what they want from a conductor, what is the dynamic between them, which is different for every conductor. If you go back to someone like George Zell, who was in Cleveland for many years, didn't allow guest conductors much. George Zell was known for, you played every note exactly the way he wanted it, period. If you had a cadenza, he would play and he would say, very nice, but that third 16th note needs to be a little bit shorter, and then five notes beyond that, I want that note to be a little bit louder. He would, every note. John Delancey was the oboist, whose son, by the way, is Q in Star Trek. Someone asked him what it was like being under George Zell. And he said, imagine being a dog on a leash. Whereas other conductors will, you know, if you don't do anything that really offends their musical taste, go for it. You know, it's a very that whole thing is also a very interesting dynamic.
And if I may add, and I mean, you might be guessing in a way this already, if you look at my background, and this is no secret, my philosophy as a conductor in the rehearsal and my attitude with the orchestra is, the first thing that I try to remember all the time is that every single person in front of me has a story, and they've put just an incredible amount of time in doing what they do. So it's really a matter of respect that I think every conductor should have for every single musician. You also don't know what happened that morning in everybody's life. So what has worked for me so far, it's I always just try to keep the focus, be respectful, keep the focus on the music, make the music better. And this has not been the Rockford Symphony Orchestra is an extraordinarily well behaved orchestra, and they've been very welcoming. Yeah,
we're well trained,
absolutely no issue. But you know, you go to Romania sometimes, and there's the occasion. I mean, there's video of Bernstein, the trumpet player, actually talking back to Bernstein, and they get into a little argument in front of. It's very quite uncomfortable. But my idea, you know, even if someone, you don't know, you really don't know what's happening in their lives, and it's so easy to react. But if someone even, let's say, challenges you for a second, if you respond nicely and extremely different tone, they're I'm telling you, they're probably not expecting that. And I've had it happen quite a few times where in places where I've been with an orchestra for a long period of time, those people that in the end maybe made some sort of a remark or something, because of a different response, they become some of my biggest supporters. I think the answer is really respect, and just keep the focus on what the job is. Just make the music better, because that's what everybody is there in the room for. No musician wants to play badly. No,
trust me. We don't want to play badly. We sometimes do, but we don't want to. And, you know, in any orchestra, any reasonable musician, you follow what the conductor does. If you personally prefer another interpretation, I used to go back and forth with Steve on certain pieces, and I'd say, well, I like it this way, and he'd say, no, too romantic. Nope. Okay, I'll play it your way. You know, that's what I'm here to do. We have just a few minutes left. Do we have any other? Okay, got a ma'am. I'm sorry? Oh, yes, it's true. We didn't get there. Tell us about the soloist.
So I personally first met Charles. It's a bit funny, but we were at a violin shop in New York. It's called Tarisio. It's a huge auction house. They handle really, really nice instruments, and there's a salesperson there, Carlos, a really friendly guy. He organizes this chamber music reading parties, where he orders just a lot of really good food and drinks, and musicians get together there and read chamber music for hours. And that's where I met Charles. We first played quartets together. And then at the beginning of the pandemic, I was on Facebook. There was not much else to do. And there was an abundance of videos that musicians were putting out, homemade videos. And I have to confess, I'm not proud of this, but you know, we're all going psychologically. It was not easy to be a musician. It was not easy to be anybody at the beginning of the pandemic. But with music, it was just really tough, because you didn't know when we're going to go back at all. So it was really hard to watch music videos in a way, because it hurt. And there was a recital that he did with a pianist. His name is Peter Dugan. So Charles and Peter recorded something for the violin channel, which was streamed online. And I remember I clicked on it and started playing. And I just ended up watching the full hour. And that's really how this program came about, because I wrote to him a few days later and I asked, are these some of these things you played on that, do you have them orchestrated already? And they weren't done, but someone was orchestrating them at the moment. And I think it was only a few weeks later that we received the email from Rockford to look into this groundbreaking, in a way, breaking between genres programs. And I proposed this program with Charles, and it worked out beautifully, because we start, if you look at the overall theme of the program, it starts from the past. There's a lot of folk inspiration. We have Tzigan Ravel, which is inspired by Hungarian music. Then there's Csárdás, which is just literally the most popular Hungarian fiddle tune you can play. I played it growing up at the weddings in Romania. And one time I was in front of, on the street, they asked us with the violist, a duo, to play Csárdás in front of the wedding and go from a house to the next. It was kind of hilarious in that way. And Dvorak also, it's inspired. Dvorak 8 is when he went back. Dvorak 7 was a tiny bit more of a political statement. Dvorak 8, he went back at Brahms's advice to Bohemian folk music, and that's where the inspiration comes from. So we start with Tsigan when he comes in, Charles, after the contemporary piece, and then we go into Csárdás, and Csárdás is going to take a turn in the middle of the Csárdás, and then we go into more adventurous territory. But he's just absolutely wonderful, and the way his arrangements break between genres, it is so seamless. You almost don't even, you can't even question it. You're just, it's like fresh air. What just happened?
He's remarkable. He's absolutely remarkable. Yes, sir.
I can't believe there are people here who have heard that, but that's just
your check is in the mail.
But it was, yeah, it was 9/11. It was a very, very moving service.
One more question, sir. Yes.
Absolutely. And I wanted it to be an introduction to whom I am as a musician when you look at the pieces of the program. But that also tells me that I get to see through the week if I can direct a little bit in the direction that I think those particular compositions should go. And it's a matter, you know, you see the flow of everything and you observe that how much can I influence a certain ensemble in the direction of what my vision is for this particular program? That is a wonderful question. But yes, absolutely. I want everybody to get an honest sense of who I am as a musician, what are the kind of things that I'm truly passionate about, and musically speaking too, the way we think about ensemble. How do I want something musically to happen? What am I going to insist on? Yes.
So how are we doing?
It's been it's been wonderful. And what I've really appreciated the orchestra going the extra mile, because I think we've worked really, really hard to the last second in every single rehearsal, and quite picky at times, and I've stopped quite a lot. And you know that I know how it feels sitting in that chair and being asked yet one more time about that thing. But I've also, what I've really, I left rehearsal last night very, very happy, because I was noticing, I noticed a lot more eye contact. And that immediately makes truly conducting possible. If nobody's looking at you, you do not.
Well, we make jokes about that, about, you know.
No, but it's true. Look what happens. The answer is nothing. It's a two-way street. I know I completely depend on the musicians. And you know, you hear that. I think there's a video of Muti, when he Ricardo Muti, where he says, "Oh, you see the newspaper the next day. Oh, Maestro Muti got this wonderful ethereal color out of the violins." And he just says, that just makes no sense. I didn't make a single sound. But and the other thing that was extraordinarily impressive to me last night, we did Tsigan Ravel. It's not by any means the first time I'm conducting the piece. I've heard it about, I don't even know, 50 times, 100 times live. And the keen listening that the orchestra was doing, of course, we had to go back and just point some things that he does. He does not play it in a he plays it in a very free way that's very, very beautiful. But the orchestra really met him right there, and that was very impressive.
Yeah, it took me a couple times through. I will admit, though, I'm like, here?
Yeah.
Now, and with the trumpet, you can't hide. You know, I mean, the fourth violinist in the third row, you know, they come in wrong, and when the trumpet comes in wrong, you know it.
And then you see the conductor two beats ahead, and he's like, they're like, is that where the solo really is? Because it can be very confusing. It's very, very tricky to do an accompaniment very well.
We're unfortunately out of time, and I could go on. As you can probably tell, I can go on forever myself. But anything you want to say in closing?
Now, I hope to see all of you. It's been a wonderful time in Rockford. I've had a lot of wonderful discussions, a lot of good food along the way. I got a wonderful tour of the city as well, which was very telling. I learned a lot. The administration has been more than welcoming, and I was truly impressed by the amount of time they dedicated to every candidate, because I know it's a lot of work, but I think it's meaningful because you really get to see what everybody truly is, and I think that's special because yes, it is a two-way street, and I just really wanted to say that I appreciate the time, and yeah, don't miss the concert tomorrow night. There's a little bit for everybody, and it's really fun.
It is. So I'd like to thank you all for coming. And as always, come to the concert tomorrow and bring three people.